bicycle crash is not an accident. And when you find yourself in a situation that calls for experienced, effective, and positive legal support and advocacy, you can depend on any of North America's independent Bike Law members. Bike Law's cycling attorneys are members of our community committed to the pursuit of cycling safety and justice. For more information about Bike Law, log on to bikelaw.com. They're on your left, protecting your rights.
Time for The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist on-air show is heard every Saturday morning, 7:30 a.m. in northeastern Ohio on WJCU 88.7 FM and streamed at WJCU.org. Our weekly podcast is available at the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com or download it with your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
And welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for January 25th, 2020. As you heard at the beginning of the show this week, I welcome Bike Law as a partner for The Outspoken Cyclist for 2020. For many years, I've thought about who might be best to collaborate with me on the show, who might be able to add real value with important and timely information that everyone who listens can use. Each week, Bike Law will offer up a couple of minutes of information, advice, and tips that will help to keep you informed from advocacy to legal details. I also encourage you to contact me with broader questions or topics you'd like Bike Law to address. Here's a quick note about the answers to last week's question, how many bicycles do you own? Holy cow, everyone. The answers ranged from 2 to people who truly did not know how many they have. They never counted them. Average seems to be somewhere in the 5 to 7 range. And remember, we consider you totally sane until after 7 bikes. Then it's anybody's guess as to your mental state. So this week's question, I'm asking, what app do you use to download the show? Simple enough. Let's get on with this week's episode. As we approach NABS 2020 coming up in March, I wanted to start introducing you to some of the newer exhibitors who will be displaying their wares in Dallas this year. This week, my first guest is Jeff Mauck. He is the founder of Juggernaut Cargo Bikes. Jeff's an interesting guy who also does not come from a bicycling background, other than the fact that he loves mountain biking, and he does come from an urban planning and architectural background. He's also quick to point out that the Juggernaut cargo bikes are built to address mobility and sustainability. Then second up is our friend Molly Herford. She's out with a new book titled The Athlete's Guide to Sponsorship. I can hardly keep up with her. She's currently in Spain, enjoying some of the best riding in the world, as she says, and is still working on her series, Shred Girls. Book number 2 comes out this summer. She states right up front in our conversation that this new book just wanted to be written. And with the subtitle of An Athlete Entrepreneur's Guide to Dreaming Big, Racing Smart, and Creating a Reliable Brand for a Long Successful Career, a big mouthful for sure. I think it was a good idea to follow the urge to put this out there for everyone to read, digest, and put into action. Finally, I'll talk with Jay Clips. He's the co-founder and race director of the Black Fork Gravel Grinder. The event takes place right here in Northeast Ohio in one of the most stunning natural regions in the state, the Mohican State Park. So it's off to Mile High City to meet Jeff Mauck of Juggernaut Cargo Bikes. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Thanks for having me on, Diane, and thanks for being a voice for the cycling community.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate you saying that. So I was going through the NABS site, as I always do this time of year, NABS 2020. I came across your name. I wanted to chat with you about your work. And as I got into your website, I realized you really don't have a quote-unquote bicycle industry background, which is awesome because it tells me you bring something else to the table. So tell us a little bit about the Juggernaut team and your varied backgrounds and how each of you fit into the company. There are basically three of you, right?
Yes, that's a good question and it does confuse people. So my background is architecture and planning, and I came to this because I was fed up with transportation and pollution and stress. So I figured that cargo bikes would be the answer. My partner has a business degree, and he's also a residential realtor, but he's also a mobility junkie. He owns all kinds of historic cars, bicycles, motorcycles, and he really liked what I was doing, and he became my partner. What he brings to this is investment when we need it most and a clear head to hear thoughts from me and make sense out of them. We've partnered with Pete Olivetti, who has his own hand-built bike company. He's building our bikes for us, and that saves us a lot of time to try and figure out other aspects of our business so we're not figuring out how to get our welds correct. My wife also helps us with communication and marketing.
So that's the basic team, the Juggernaut team. How'd you come up with the name Juggernaut?
Juggernaut is an unstoppable force.
That's true.
And that's what we intend to be. And the elephant in Indian culture pulls a juggernaut cart as part of one of their ceremonies. So I thought there was a nice little tie in there.
Quite so. Quite so. I like that. What made you come from your background and your partner's backgrounds and come up with cargo bikes? I mean, it's a very specific, small, niche market in the bicycle world.
It is. I came from a bicycling background anyway. I really love mountain biking. One of the reasons I live in Colorado, can access the desert too. Moab's just 5 hours down the road. And bicycling in the city, what, 6 or 7 years ago when I started looking at this, wasn't a real option. You had to really love it. There wasn't a clear A to B path to get where you need to be. And it was kind of dangerous. So I figured that the best way to get from A to B is on a cargo bike because it gets to carry more items, people, whatever you want to carry. So it becomes a replacement for your car within the city. And that's only gotten better recently with the addition of electric assist. You can haul more, push more weight.
I wanted to ask you how you see, because what you state on your website is that you're a mobility company and you're looking at cargo bikes to improve mobility. What do you see as the market for that? So, you know, we look at cargo bikes and it's so tiny right now. And I'm wondering, in Colorado, are you seeing more people using cargo bikes? And are people contacting you about your particular products?
Yes, we are seeing an uptick, and that's only within the last year or two. There were a few people at my kids' school from Amsterdam. They imported their own. But you see a lot of adoption from people that have gone to Europe, right? And they see how successful it is there, and so they bring them back here. There's a cargo bike store that recently opened about a year or two ago here in Denver, and they have a limited supply of long johns and long tails. So there is a slow uptick, but to get back to your mobility item, bikes aren't mobility alone. Mobility is a system, right? Talks about connectivity, safety, affordability, time, and resources. That system also has bikes as part of the element, right? So you have public transportation, you have scooters, bikes, pathways for pedestrians. So the best way I can explain it is first we need a better infrastructure, and then we'll have more adoption. For me personally, I think that cargo bikes are the better answer because you can do more on a cargo bike, especially a three-wheeled cargo bike.
So I want to talk about the bikes themselves in a few moments, but I want to ask you if you see, because clearly you've come to this from a different perspective, about changing the way Americans think about mobility and about using bicycles for transportation. Are you seeing changes like that? And if you are, how? And if you're not, how can we begin to get people to look at bicycles for transportation more than the 1% or 2% that we see for the most part now?
Yep, that's a pretty layered and developed answer that I need to come up with. It's a cocktail that I've been trying to put together for a few years in my observations and spending time on different mobility councils. And it really boils down to I'm going to hit the bullet points and develop those in a second. Infrastructure, tax credits, technology, security, health and environment, cost, and fun. So the most successful examples that we see right now are in Northern Europe. Sometimes we can see that in Brazil and Asia, but mostly Northern Europe, where investment in infrastructure on a government level has been phenomenal. And then the tax credits feed into giving people the adoption for an electric assist bike, because the electricity on a bike is what costs a lot. So governments have been giving subsidies of 20 to 30% towards the purchase of a bike. Between those two, the adoption rates have risen dramatically. And then when you look at a cargo bike, it becomes real transportation at that point. Cargo bikes typically were for diehard cyclists with strong legs because they're pushing a lot of weight. Now anyone can get on one, no matter the ability, the age. The electricity is what makes that an option. Another thing we need to focus on is security. It's hard for people to dash in and out of stores. Right now, the infrastructure might not be there for parking. So if you can park the bike really quickly, and what I'm going to do is put the frame lock on the back tire, as well as the Bosch e-assist system that we use. If you take the screen off, it freezes the motor. So if you don't have a pole or a bike rack to lock that to, that gives you more comfort to leave it for a few seconds. It's a big bike, so you're not going to have one person throw it over a shoulder and take off with it. It's about 89 pounds, so it's big. The other factors, and I'll get through this quickly, health and environment, right? You want to be healthy, you ride your bike. It's probably some of the most fun and exercise put together that people have during a work week. And you're saving the environment because you're not putting out green, gases. Our cost savings, by riding a bike, you're saving money. You don't pay for gas. You're not paying for insurance. You're not paying for oil, parking. You're not wasting time and being stressed out in traffic. And that's what makes it fun. I think that people forget that being on a bike, it's freedom, right? We've been in SUVs for so long. We forget that cycling is self-sufficiency, therapeutic. Takes us back to our roots, engages us with our environment. Again, an urban planning part of this, which is if you want to connect people with their region or their city, you have to shed yourself with a car, right? You're having more interactions with people, with your neighbors, with store owners. As you're biking through town, you experience more. You're more connected.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Jeff Mauck. He is the founder of Juggernaut Cargo Bikes out of Denver. Interesting conversation. I have some kind of devil's advocate questions kind of at the back of my mind, but I'm going to leave them alone for now about how we can actually get people to agree. They wouldn't disagree with anything you've said, but I think there's a lot of skepticism about whether we would get tax credits, whether there would be subsidies, whether there are cost savings, and whether the infrastructure will ever catch up with what we need to make it safe. And I think that's been an issue right along. I'm not sure that what we're seeing out of legislation is helping us much, even though there's a lot of stuff going on advocacy-wise to try and make that happen. But I have to agree with all your points. The question is, will all that happen, and will it only happen in spotty places? You know, we need sort of this larger view is what I really would like to see.
Well, you're 100% correct in your assessment. And that's what frustrates me and some of my colleagues the most, is there seems to be a disconnect between the government and the will of the people. I'll be going to Germany to better understand why they're so successful at doing what they do. From what I read from afar and I talk to people online, the infrastructure for communication is better. They're not assuming that they know best as a government. They get in there and they talk with people from varied backgrounds, white collar, blue collar, retired, young, middle-aged, doesn't matter. If people are adopting a product and they're dying because they're getting hit by cars, the government is right there with them to figure out, what do we need to do? How do we make this better? We have a lot of ground-level advocacy in Colorado. There's a lot of will for people to want to have better infrastructure, and it is happening in piecemeal efforts. But the larger scale is we need to show them examples of adoption, which is why I'm choosing to go to Germany in April, attend two bike conferences, and meet with politicians and bike advocates to see how we can transfer these ideas and bring them back here.
Let's take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to talk to Jeff about the bikes that he is making. I want to at least get some information about the actual Juggernaut cargo bikes. Interesting conversation. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Jeff Mauck. He is the founder of Juggernaut Cargo Bikes out of Denver. We've had an interesting conversation so far about what it might take to change the way people think about using bicycles. I mean, we have this conversation a lot, Jeff. This is not new, but I think you've brought some interesting things to the conversation by talking about what's going on in other countries in the world that we haven't talked about. You know, everybody says you can ride a bike all the time in Amsterdam, you can ride a bike all the time in Copenhagen, but nobody's ever talked to me about the communication between people and government and infrastructure in terms of what you're going to probably see when you go to Germany in April. So I do want to talk about your bikes, though. I do not want to leave this conversation without talking about the two models you're offering. One's called the Original Guru, one's called the Improved Guru. Tell us a little bit about what goes into each of these bikes and what's different about Juggernaut bikes, because there's some really interesting fabrication pieces to this.
Sure. Happy to. So the Original Guru was our first bike, and I designed it to figure out if the full suspension was worth having, and does it work, and do people like it? I've been to different bike festivals and gotten a lot of good feedback. So that's the reason I designed it. I designed it with 24-inch front wheels. Some of the competitors from around the globe have much smaller front wheels. I didn't want to fall in a pothole and not have the ability to come out. That's why I have a larger diameter in the front. I have a double-tiered frame, so it's very, very strong. And the suspension also leads you to having better steering, so it doesn't skip when you go into a corner. Has the Ackerman equation like cars and trucks do, figured out. That was the prototype. The improved Guru builds upon that. We're going to have a more manufacturable process. You'll see a lot of straight cuts on the old model. We're going to be bending tubing to take out labor and hence cost. Adding e-assist. We're adding belt steering as well as having belt drive from the last model. And we're basically focusing on this becoming a faster, more efficient mobility product.
How heavy are these bikes?
Right now, we have a bill of materials that we've added up. We're between 89 and 94 pounds. We'll know better April 15th or so. Once the bike is completed, we're going to be at NABS, which is what we're racing to get this done for. But one of the other elements of why we're building five bikes for 2020 is we're doing the Ride for the Brand program.
Wait, which is the Ride for what?
It's called Ride for the Brand.
Hmm. Okay, tell me about it.
So we're going to be selecting people from the business community, last mile delivery community, and just general consumers, and giving them 1 week trial periods. This way we can gather information on the bike and how people like it. It'll educate the public as to what a cargo bike is, and it'll just generally spread the word and support for this market category in the U.S. We're going to be doing this between Denver, Boulder, and Aspen.
Nice. That sounds interesting. That altitude gets me, so I would be a terrible candidate for all of that. Terrible.
Why? Why?
I'm just not good at altitude, you know? We're only like a couple hundred feet above sea level here in Northeast Ohio. You guys are at like thousands of feet. Isn't Denver the Mile High City?
Yes. Drink more water. You'll be fine.
Thank you so much. Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Jeff Mock. He is the founder of Juggernaut Cargo Bikes. So each of these bikes is made to order. So is there something you can do that would change a bike from bike to bike?
We're going to harness this feedback that we gather all summer long. I don't want to assume that this is a bike that I've designed and everyone's going to love it. What if they don't? So I want to incorporate people's feedback and make changes where needed before mass production. To customize a bike is very expensive. What I would rather do is customize it for a last mile delivery customer. If that last mile delivery customer is listening and they're out there, I would like to ask you to contact me. I would be happy to help design a bike for last mile delivery.
Explain who you mean by last mile delivery customer.
UPS.
Ah.
FedEx.
Ah.
DHL.
Yeah.
They're doing this in Europe. But I would like to implement a design that I'm thinking about here in the United States.
So you're looking really at fleets of bicycles. Of cargo bikes?
For last mile delivery, yes. I would like to have a bike that suits their needs. And for everyone else, I would like to have one bike that we can use globally.
That's interesting. I assume you know about World Bicycle Relief and their Buffalo bike, which they build for the African market, and they have a new one that they're building for the South American market. But that's a pretty interesting concept, and I understand perfectly what that means. So let's talk a second about what kind of cargo these bikes can carry. So if you're looking at a last mile delivery guy, like, let's say, we'll just pick the big one, Amazon, and you're going to fill that bike with cargo, how many stops is this Amazon guy going to be able to make weight-wise? Or girl?
Weight-wise, you can carry 300 pounds.
Wow.
Plus rider.
Wow.
Yes.
That's a lot.
It's a strong bike.
Yeah.
That's why I have a double-tiered frame. But for last mile delivery, the real key is to be up around 74 cubic square feet.
Ah.
Okay. And you're talking about a bike that has a much longer cargo area in the front.
How unwieldy is it to steer?
It's not. It's
okay.
Very easy.
Okay.
When are you gonna come out to Denver and try it?
Well, actually, I'm hoping to be at NABS to see. Will you have one there at NABS?
Yeah, I'm going to have the new one at NABS.
Well, there you have it. So I'm hoping to be there. But it just sounds so interesting. You have such a different approach. It's not like you're trying to make a bunch of bikes and sell them. You're looking at what the real end game is. And I'm not seeing that from a lot of people. I really like it. I think it's very, very interesting and has a lot of thought behind it, which is why you didn't come from the bike industry, strangely enough. So you did say, let's just talk a second about the nuts and bolts of the e-bike. It's a Bosch system you're using?
Bosch CX.
Okay.
We're going to have the new Kiox screen, which, as I mentioned before, when you remove the screen, it freezes the motor. So it makes your bike, it renders it impossible to pedal.
Nice.
We're going to have the Enviolo CA drivetrain. We're going to have our proprietary suspension. What you might have seen on the old Guru, the original Guru, was a wood front. We're going to move over to a plastic product called Starboard. It is a material that they make boats out of, so that you can park this outside and not worry about it.
Okay, that's pretty cool. And you're using Gates? You're using Carbon Drive?
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it sounds like a super well thought out bike. I want to make a comment about your website. Who did your little graphic? It's so cute. This little cargo bike goes pedaling across the screen. I love it.
Our web designer came up with that.
And you used a woman. I really appreciate that there's a girl on that bike and not a guy. I love it.
We're inclusive.
We are inclusive.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, so let's tell listeners how they can find out more about Juggernaut. And then do you already know your booth number at NABS?
I do, but I don't have it in front of me.
Yeah, that's okay. I'm sure they'll be able to find it. It's a big convention hall, but you know what? NABS is going to be in one part of it. Go ahead and tell people about your website.
It's juggernautcargobikes.com. And please go there and check it out.
Yes, absolutely. And it's an interesting website. I really enjoyed reading about you and your team. Oh, I wanted to ask you one question, which I was going to ask you at the beginning, and I didn't. You've got a really comprehensive advisory board, and you've picked a lot of people. They're from, you know, government, and they're from advocacy, and they're from business. How did you come up with that particular mix of advisors?
I have seen people start businesses in the past. And I wanted to have a broad range of perspectives and be able to tap into resources such as our lawyers without actually having to go to the lawyers that we pay for all the time. The bike advocates are great because they keep us up to date on their policy changes and what they're working on. We have someone that has actually started and sold his distillery business. He gives us valuable advice on how to carefully grow a business. And then we've got our designers on the other end, urban planner and an architect that give me feedback, and they understand the way I think.
So you said distillery?
Yes, High West Distillery.
What was he distilling?
Whiskey.
Not bourbon, though. Bourbon
Park
comes
City.
From Kentucky.
okay. This was Park City, Utah.
Great guy to have on board.
Yeah, he ended up selling it to Constellation Brands, so he did pretty well.
Yeah, I guess he did. Well, Jeff, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. We've been talking with Jeff Mauck. He is the founder of Juggernaut Cargo Bikes. It's juggernautcargobikes.com. He'll be at NABS coming up, and I wish you a lot of luck. I really like the way you think. Thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today.
Thank you very much, Diane.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Jeff Mauck joined me from his office at Juggernaut Cargo Bikes in Denver, Colorado. Juggernaut will be among the exhibitors at this year's NABS show in Dallas from March 14th through 16th. If you're interested in seeing the bikes, you can stop by and tell them you heard about it on the show. If you can't attend NABS, you can still find out about Juggernaut at juggernautcargobikes.com. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, I have a message about legislation that might just change the way people think in Florida, which, as we know, is not the safest place to ride or walk. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Back, I'm Diane Jenks. Back in November of 2018, 34-year-old Nicole Vanderwhite decided to take her eyes off the road while driving and plowed into 15 cyclists in Broward County, Florida, killing Denise Marsh and Carlos Rodriguez and injuring several other riders in the group. Recently, Ms. Vanderwhite received her sentence in court, a $1,000 civil penalty. She has to do 120 hours of community service, and her license will be suspended for 6 months. The outrage was loud and long. I would suggest none of us believes justice was served here, and as the Florida legislature goes into its yearly sessions, our friends at Bike Law have developed and are promoting a Vulnerable Road User Act. Should the Florida legislature both take it up and pass it, the penalties for injuring and or killing anyone using the roads, from skateboarders and wheelchair-bound people to highway service people and, of course, cyclists, will be dramatically increased. If you are in Florida and are interested in weighing in, please contact your Florida state legislators as soon as possible. You can also contact Rachel at bikelaw.com. So let's get back to the show. Molly Herford is a force to be reckoned with. She's probably one of the most busy people I know. She and her husband run the active blog, theoutdooredit.com. Molly writes for a bunch of publications. She writes books. She does podcasts. She rides a lot. She's also a coach and a yoga instructor, and I'm sure I left something out. Her new book, The Athlete's Guide to Sponsorship, is a comprehensive look into everything from how to conduct yourself in public to how to approach sponsors. It covers a huge swath of topics, culminating in a big chapter on the business of fitness. Hi, Molly. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. It's good to talk with you again. You are in Spain. That is so nice.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically cycling paradise here, so I have no complaints whatsoever.
I guess not. And you're escaping the winter, which is lovely. Well, don't you usually live in Canada?
Yeah. When not on the road, we're actually just north of Toronto, where it is currently, I believe, negative 20 in Fahrenheit. So I am pretty happy to not be there right now, much as I love the community.
I won't even ask what the temperature is in Spain. Don't tell me. Don't tell me. So 2020, new year, new book, and it's a good time. I know, right? What else did you have to do all summer? So it's a good time to be launching it because it's just the season as it begins. We talk a lot about sponsorship. This one's called The Athlete's Guide to Sponsorship. And the bottom part, which is really interesting, sort of your subtitle, An Athlete Entrepreneur's Guide to Dreaming Big, Racing Smart, Creating a Reliable Brand for a Long, Successful Career. That's a mouthful, but it makes a lot of sense. What brought you to writing this book?
This one is, there are just some books that need to kind of come out of you. You just can't help but write them. And this is one of those. you know, having been in the cycling industry as pretty much every different job you could possibly do, from, you know, racing myself to managing teams to obviously being in cycling media to, you know, talking to a lot of brands and sponsorship coordinators sort of throughout those jobs, and then coaching a lot of younger riders that are, you know, we're all looking for teams and stuff. I saw, frankly, a lot of don'ts and very few do's. So I kind of started writing this a few years back as almost a grumpy guide to what not to do. And obviously it evolved a lot from there. And I think it's a lot more positive than the original drafts were. But yeah, it was just a book that wanted to get written by me.
Well, it's not too grumpy. Actually, it's got some really positive things. Beginning on the first page after the introduction, the golden rule, which sounds really simple, but one of the things you say right off the bat is don't be, and we won't use the word on the air. You can fill in the blank. Don't be one of those. So,
yeah.
How did you start with that? I mean, it's obviously really simple, but it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I mean, that one basically just covers almost everything else that's in the book. You know, whether you're talking about how to come off on social media or how to approach sponsors or how to, you know, deal with the host at your host house or, you know, your fellow competitors in a race. It all comes back to that whole treat others the way you want to be treated. I mean, a lot of the time when you're a young athlete, you're looking at sponsorship as this thing that someone can give to you. But, you know, at the same time, you wouldn't want to be treated like a commodity or like you have a price tag on your forehead. So, you know, it's just kind of a reminder that every time you're dealing with someone in the industry, you're dealing with a person at some point. You might think you're only dealing with a big bike company or a big shoe company, but there's a person on the other end of that. So the golden rule of, you know, the nicer version is, you know, do unto others as you would want them to do unto you. But yeah, my pithy version is don't be a
I guess for the podcast, we could just say it and then bleep it for the broadcast, but
I always wanted to be bleeped.
Let people fill in their own blank, because I can think of several possible words for that. So you have some other preliminary points that you make, like don't quit your day job, find your niche. What are some of those points and why are they so close to the front of the book?
Yeah, I wanted to really start with don't quit your day job yet, because I think there's a lot of young athletes in particular, but I mean, you know, plenty of us in our 30s and 40s, I've actually talked to a lot of people who've been reading the book who are in their 40s and 50s, you know, who love sport and, you know, kind of want to think about turning pro. But for the most part, a lot of pros, especially in the world of endurance sport, have day jobs. And I mean, for a lot of them, to be totally honest, the day job is actually what keeps them, I'd almost say, in a better position, both in terms of not necessarily needing a sponsor to come in with a dollar figure, so their racing is not dictated by what a sponsor wants them to do, or, you know, whether or not they can afford to get the stuff because they have a regular job. But it also gives people something extra to do. I don't think people realize how hard it is to actually be a pro athlete and you know, basically train and then recover all day. There's a lot of downtime there. And I mean, granted, later in the book, I talk about all the ways you could fill that downtime with, the ways to keep your sponsors happy. But you know, for the most part, I think most of us would actually do better keeping our day jobs and operating on the side. So I think before anyone starts thinking about how to become a full-time professional athlete, it's really important to think about, do you really want this? Because it's going to be really, really hard. And maybe you would rather just race for fun on the weekend.
Yeah, right. Not everybody's a Tiger Woods, right?
Exactly.
So you have a lot of really interesting questions that you ask. Things like, how do you choose sponsors to go after, which is really an interesting question. It's like, well, yes, everybody needs a bike. Everybody needs shoes. Everybody needs jerseys and shorts. And making the right choices in sponsors is an important thing to do, how to keep sponsors happy. So let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Molly Herford. She has written a new book, Miss Shred Girl Herself, The Athlete's Guide to Sponsorship. And I think it's something that anybody who is looking to get something back as a professional or as an elite athlete would benefit from. And even if not, it sort of gives you a really deep dive into what a professional athlete might even have to go through, even if you don't want to do it yourself. So tell us the difference.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. What's the difference between an influencer and an athlete? I thought that that was a really interesting distinction.
Yeah, so this is something that's really come up in the last only, you know, few years with the rise of social media, obviously. And, you know, a lot of pro athletes will kind of roll their eyes at this because it is a little frustrating. But ultimately, a professional athlete is someone, you know, whose sponsors come based on their results, largely. I mean, social media and presence and brand come into it, but for the most part, sponsors are looking at your results when you're an athlete. That's your main selling point. When you're an influencer, though, you maybe don't race. You might not even race at all. Maybe you race very casually. Maybe you race sort of more towards the back of the pack. But where your value comes from is what you can offer in terms of your online presence. Most people know Instagram influencer, but you could also be, you know, YouTube. You could have your own blog or website, or even just be huge on Twitter. And a lot of, you know, a lot of people are athletes/influencers. They kind of blend together a little bit, but depending on which one you are is going to depend on how you're approaching sponsors. For example, if you're an influencer, you're less likely to be, you know, providing your race results, especially if all you have is I finished several fondos or something like that. But, you know, you have this many followers. And if you're an athlete, you're going to lead with here's my race results. And then under that is going to be here's what my, you know, personal brand looks like.
So what you're saying is somebody who is in the field, let's say as a cyclist or as a runner or as even a swimmer or triathlete, doesn't actually have to be on the podium to be a sponsored person, so that some of the influential things they do through social media, especially these days, can earn them an income.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think at this point you need to necessarily be on the podium to be, you know, a sponsored athlete, especially if you think about, you know, me being on the podium at a local race that has 30 participants versus, you know, being, you know, if you want to look at like a World Cup race, if you finish 50th in a World Cup, you're still going to get a lot more eyeballs on you at that World Cup. But if I finish, you know, 10th at my local race with 40 people, but I have an Instagram following of 40,000, which
right.
is not the case for me, by the way, that would also make me really valuable to sponsors.
Right. That makes so much sense. I wanted to tackle social media, but we kind of just did. But are there specific platforms that you think lend themselves to certain personalities?
Yeah, I mean, right now, Instagram is obviously sort of the go-to, especially in the influencer space. And, you know, it's doing a ton with video and more Instagram live type stuff. So you can be kind of in contact with your audience all day. But that takes a really specific kind of personality who can be engaging and interacting all day. If you're someone who really enjoys video and creating kind of beautiful stories, then, you know, for you, YouTube might be a better place to kind of focus on putting together really kind of more thought out long form videos and have them out and not be as, you know, interactive. If you're a writer, I still think there's a spot for you in the blog world. I know blogs are kind of a bit of a dinosaur in terms of the world of social media, but I still think if you really love writing and you think you can tell a great story that way, I think there's still plenty of space for that, or at least a very long Instagram caption if you're not going to go into the blog sphere.
Well, I agree. I actually write a blog every week to accompany the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And you're a writer, you know, you've got your outdoor edit. Yeah, I think writing is... There are a lot of people who still read. Let's just put it that way. Not everybody is on screen all day just playing and looking at cats and food.
Exactly.
I also want to talk about your final chapter, which, I mean, there are tons of other great pieces of advice in this book. But your final chapter is about fitness and the business of fitness. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, most people think of being a professional athlete as this idea that all you do all day is you train and then you're recovering and you're eating and you're Instagramming, you know, about your cat or your podium legs or whatever thing you're doing. But man, having worked with a lot of professional athletes now, there is so much work that goes into it. I mean, organizing your, especially in endurance sport where you're doing a lot of the organizing, or at least you need to be on top of the organizing. You don't have necessarily a team bus or a chauffeur that's going to make sure you get to the airport on time to catch your flight. You really need to keep all of your stuff so together and so organized, especially if you're actually going to be making money. So I wanted to include this last section that's, you know, all about how to keep your stuff organized, how to make sure that you're, you know, appropriately staying in touch with your sponsors, how to actually think about going into contracts, and the reminder that you really need to get everything in writing these days. And, just, you know, the reminder that just because you get a contract doesn't mean you necessarily need to say yes to it right away. You do actually still need to look these things over. They're legal documents. Even if you're, you know, an 18-year-old getting on your first team and you're just getting, you know, a sweet deal on stock, you're still signing something that's legally binding. So, you know, it's a very important reminder that you're a business person. Like, you are your brand, you are your business, and that means you need to act like a business person, not just someone who can run a lot of miles really quick or ride a lot of miles really quick.
That's a really, really good point. So I want to talk a little bit about the new website, theathletesguidetosponsorship.com. I know it isn't complete yet. I went out there yesterday, but you're going to have tips and templates for resumes, links to interviews and podcasts. When will that be available, and what else will people be able to do on that? It's nice. It'll be an interactive site.
It's sort of a slow build now. I'm kind of steadily getting, you know, pumping new content out there pretty much weekly at this point. It'll continue to grow. But yeah, I mean, I really wanted to kind of create a place where people could go after they read the book, or, you know, even before they read the book, to see, what does a good race resume look like? You know, where can I get a template for this? What are these, you know, resources? I talk a ton about sites like, you know, using Canva for designing your race resume. And I want to make sure people can easily find that. And like, here's the best template for a race resume. And then, you know, I really love the case study of things that I've been able to do in the book. And I want to kind of continue doing them with real life racers who are making things work now on kind of every different level, from, you know, your small local pro who's getting by and kind of enjoying racing to the person who's, you know, funding a whole team based on their results. Slow but steady growth on the site, basically.
Sure. Absolutely. And as, you know, adding things all the time also influences people to come back. You know, it reminds
exactly.
them there might be something else coming up. So I need two things. One is, how can listeners get a copy of the book? Did you publish this yourself?
I did, actually, yeah.
Nice
it's a
job.
A very, very niche topic. Thank you.
I know how I got my copy, but I'm not telling. So you have to tell how you got yours.
You can find it at athletesguidetosponsorship.com or at theoutdooredit.com is where my stuff lives. So where I and Molly Herford have all of my information and all of the books that I publish are over there. Or you can just search for it on Amazon. I think at this point, if you type in athlete sponsorship, it's the first thing that comes up. And yeah, you can find me at Molly J. Herford on Twitter and Instagram if you forgot the link, and I can send it to you there.
Okay, that's perfect. Last question is, how's the Shred Girls series coming?
So good. Book number 2 is out this July. It's Allie's Rocky Ride and all about mountain biking, and they get outside and, you know, adventures happen.
There you go. Adventures do happen almost on a daily basis. Well, Molly, enjoy your stay in Spain. When are you coming home?
In March, actually. So we've got a ways to go.
You do. Well, have fun. Thanks so much for talking with me, and thanks for writing this book.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Take care.
You too.
Molly Herford joined me from Girona, Spain. If you're interested in obtaining a copy of her new book, The Athlete's Guide to Sponsorship, you can log on to theoutdooredit.com, theathletesguidetosponsorship.com, or you can call up the Amazon beast. So let's take another short break, and we'll be back to wrap up the show with Jay Clips from the Black Fork Gravel Grinder. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We're back. I'm Diane Jenks, and this is The Outspoken Cyclist. Born out of a need to train for a different event, Jay Clips and Matt Simpson, who are lifelong friends, decided to take their training grounds in Northeast Ohio's beautiful Mohican State Park and turn it into an event, the Black Fork Gravel Grinder. I'll let Jay tell you more. Hi, Jay. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week. Let's talk gravel grinder. What do you think?
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
No, it's my pleasure. So Black Fork Gravel Grinder is right here in Ohio, which is awesome. I'm seeing so many new events in Ohio, which makes me feel like we're back in the cycling state. Tell us the origins of the Black Fork Gravel Grinder.
So this event was born out of what I would call a necessity. The co-director of this event and myself, his name is Matt Simpson. He's a good friend of mine, has been for over 40 years now. And yes, we've been riding together for 40 years. He and I had to find some elevation while we were training for 100 mile mountain bike events, and we needed to find it in the spring. And as you know, in Ohio, finding mountain bike trails in the spring is nearly impossible. So we found elevation on these gravel roads near where we grew up. And we realized that they were super cool, and we wanted to get more people out there. So that's how we started talking about the Black Fork.
When did it actually start? What was the first year that you produced the event?
So we were training on these roads in 2014 and 15, started talking about it then, and our first event was in 2016.
Wow. So this year coming up will be the fourth year. That's pretty cool. There's an amazing video. I really loved your video. I don't know who did it, but they did a really good job on it. My favorite guy is the one who goes mud, gravel, and beer. He's a character. But anyway.
And he's got a great story. He came in dead last a few years back. And it was his first gravel event, and we were there at the finish line with a bunch of guys that had already finished and gals. And we cheered him on and gave him a big hug and a cold six-pack of beer and fed him some barbecue. And he's been a huge part of Black Fork ever since. And by the way, he's not coming in last anymore. He's out hitting every gravel event he can. So we like to think that his experience at the Black Fork that year helped get him hooked on gravel.
Which a lot of people seem to be getting hooked on. It's very interesting watching the sport change and grow and expand. I really like it. You say that the roads are scenic, grueling, and diverse. How many ride options are there? And do each of those options include a full variety of terrain?
They do. So we have three route options, 23 miles, 30 miles, and our race route is 54. And they all will have varied terrain, about 80% gravel and some intermittent small sections of tarmac. And the gravel varies itself from smooth to fast and rocky to double track. You get just about everything. You're going to find potholes full of mud and water, and so you're going to get everything out there.
It's a little boy's dream.
It is a little boy's dream. Yep. All route options spend the first five-ish miles together before splitting off, and then again return back together, intertwining through their miles, and then ultimately finishing together.
So we'll tell people where it is. I wanted to ask a couple of other questions about rest stops and food and how many people. So I guess each option has rest stops along the way.
Yes, they do. You will get one rest stop for the 23 and 30 mile routes. You get two rest stops for the 54. They're going to be stocked, fully stocked and fully manned. You're going to have all kinds of different snacks, Hammer Nutrition products. Hammer's a sponsor of ours, and they send a ton of stuff. And of course, water.
Of course. I was going to ask if there was beer, but it's probably a little early for beer. I imagine that the starts are in the morning, not in the afternoon.
A lot of our riders would probably love to have beer, and we do have a lot of beer, and we have free beer, and we have plenty of it, but it's not at the rest stops. So you have to cross that finish line to get that hand up.
I think that's a really good idea. Have drunk people on the course is probably not a good idea. So let's talk a second about Mohican. Mohican Wilderness Campground, it's in Grafton, Ohio. Explain, so if people can imagine what the state of Ohio looks like, tell them about where Grafton is. I mean, I know, but they may not.
So you will not find Grafton on a map anywhere. It's the closest small town, really, is Loudonville, and it's about 9 miles south of Loudonville. And it is directly centered between Columbus and Cleveland. So you're going to get about an hour and 15 minutes either way from whether you're coming north or coming south from Columbus or Cleveland.
So people come from, I imagine, even a bigger radius than that. I mean, Mohican is supposed to be magnificent. It's just the whole area is beautiful.
It is. It's a great area. Matt and I grew up just east of the Mohican area. So we got to see this stuff as we were growing up as kids on little BMX bikes. But we have riders coming from all over the country. We have riders coming from Canada. They're already signed up this year. We had Ben Peacock from Scotland come a few years back. And we have some riders coming this year from Lof, and they're located in Iceland. So we're, I guess you can call us international.
I guess you could. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Jay Clips. He is the ride director, one of them, of the Black Fork Gravel Grinder right here in Ohio, which is awesome. We will give the dates and all the other pertinent stuff as we move on. So do you have a cap on the number of participants who can come? Can you accommodate, you know, like hundreds?
We can accommodate hundreds. Yes, we do cap it out. We capped it out this year at 400. We've grown every year. We had 100 the first year, and we've grown by just about 100 every year. But to hold an exceptional event where everybody has a great time and quality is job one, it must be under control. And so to keep that control, we capped it this year at 400. And I know that makes some late registering riders upset sometimes, but we just feel that it's important to keep it under control. We are about 50% full now after about a week and a half. So if there's somebody out there that wants to get registered, they'll need to do it pretty quick. We expect to sell out in the next couple of weeks.
You know what? First come, first serve. I totally get it. Been a ride director, a race director. I understand you need to be able to have safety and be able to keep an eye on all of these riders. Let's talk a moment about the 54-mile route, the long route. It's actually a race. So I assume there are prizes and a podium and all of that?
Yeah, we have a $2,400 cash purse.
Wow.
Plus prizes. Yes, we have podiums. Our podiums are super nice. My brother handmade them out of reclaimed cherry barn wood, and they're beautiful. And we made our signage by hand as well. So we have some of the best signs out there.
Talk to me about the diversity of the participant. Do you allow children under 18? Is there a kids ride? There probably is not.
We don't have kids rides, but we do allow under 18 as long as they're accompanied by, you know, their parents or, yep.
Okay. My next question is about the difference in numbers for men and women. I saw in the video there were plenty of women riding. Can you give us an idea of how many women compared to how many men?
So this is something we're actually working on very diligently, and we're trying to figure out how to get more women. We have about 25% coming that are women, which leaves 75% men, and we would really like that to be more of a 50-50 split. And so we do a lot of work, and we're very thoughtful about how we're making our event more diverse. And one way we're doing that, and I'm not sure there's any gravel events in the region that do this, but we have two ride options and then a race option, because we know that to get folks that have never been on gravel or folks that may have never even raced before out there, it's pretty intimidating. And that's not what we want. We want inclusivity. And we want everybody to come out and have a good time. And we're going to treat the last 23-miler or the first place 54-miler all the same. They're all going to get the same cheers. They're going to get that beer hand up, the hug at the end. And so we just want to get more folks, more diversity. We want to get more ladies out there because we know there are a ton of ladies that are out riding and they're working just as hard as the men are. And so we're working on that and we're very thoughtful about it.
That's excellent. Are you recommending a specific kind of bike? I mean, you know, everybody talks about quote unquote gravel bikes these days. Those are things that we used to build years ago. They used to call them all-purpose touring bikes, but today they're a little different. Are you suggesting a suspension bike, or can people just bring their quote-unquote gravel bikes?
So if you ask that question to 10 different people, you get 10 different answers.
Awesome.
And so we won't highly recommend anything.
Okay.
And Matt and I differ, and we argue about this all the time. We're both mountain bikers at core, and he likes to ride his mountain bike on this route. I like to ride a drop bar cross bike or a gravel bike, but it really doesn't matter. And we will allow anything in this race, with the exception of the pedal assist or the e-bikes. We had a fellow ride a couple years back. He wanted to be into Black Fork so badly, and he knew that he had to watch his daughter, his 3-year-old daughter, on that day. But he registered anyway. Put her in a trailer and pulled her for the full 23 miles in a trailer. She came across the line, the finish line, with a peanut butter jelly sandwich in her hand and peanut butter jelly all over her face with a huge grin. So we'll allow anything in, pretty much ride anything you want over a 25 millimeter tire and still be just fine. You may have more fun on a mountain bike because some of the downhills are pretty fast. But anybody can do anything. Now, our winners, our fastest guys, do ride on the drop bar, gravel type, or cyclocross bikes.
Okay. Let's get to some of the details. What's the date of the event?
So it's our expo, which includes packet pickup. We'll have a bunch of vendors, beer, music, fire pits, demos. It's on Friday night, May 1st, from 6 to 9. And then the event itself starts on Saturday, May 2nd at 10 a.m. sharp. It's a mass rollout for all racers and riders. And you can pick up your packets on Saturday morning as well, starting at 8 a.m.
Okay. And if people need to find out more information, how do they get that?
So Matt, my partner, he does a great job with our website, and it has all the information you're going to need. And that's at www.blackforkgravelgrinder.com. We also have a Facebook page. If you like that, you'll get the updates and all the goings-on.
Well, it sounds like a really cool event. I have one more question, and that is about your sponsors. You have a committed core of sponsors, and we talk about sponsorship on this show a lot. How you get sponsors, how you keep them engaged, and how you get them to participate. So just briefly, what have you done to make your sponsors happy?
Well, really this is easy when you're committed to something and when you're this passionate about something. Our mission statement, to cultivate an awareness and passion for gravel road riding, challenge riders with all abilities and backgrounds, and do this by staging epic event, is really where it comes from. And that commitment to gravel road cycling is what keeps our sponsors coming back. We're out there everywhere. Our reach is enormous, and we talk gravel to everyone. So, of course, we're going to be talking about our sponsors as well. I do quote-unquote market research. We go all over the country to different gravel events, and we'll race in these events, and we'll see what they have that would be good for us, and see what they have that wouldn't be good for us and not do those things. So we're out there, and that's what keeps our sponsors coming back. I think it's our commitment and our passion.
I think that's a really good idea, and it sounds wonderful. If you go to the website blackforkgravelgrinder.com and you just scroll down on their sponsor list, it's pretty vast, and it's some people you'll recognize. There'll also be people you don't recognize. I have a question. Is Wootown Bagels from Worcester?
Yes, they are.
I just asked because my sister used to own a company called Woo City Ice Cream, and that was in Worcester.
Yeah. Not far from Ooster, and Wootown Bagels is awesome. They come out, though. They will provide everybody breakfast before the event on Saturday.
That sounds great. Well, Jay, thanks so much for talking with me. We've been talking with Jay Clips. He is the ride director for the Black Fork Gravel Grinder, May 1st. If you want to register, you need to do it sooner rather than later. It's going to fill up. Thanks for talking with me, Jay. Have a wonderful event this year, and I hope the weather's good. Or not. It is gravel after all.
That's right. Thank you very much.
All righty. Take care.
Bye-bye.
My thanks to Jay Clips from the Black Fork Gravel Grinder. As he said, if you're interested in participating in this year's event, you might want to get on board sooner than later. For more information, you can log on to blackforkgravelgrinder.com. Phew, that was a big show, and I hope you enjoyed it. My thanks to Jeff Mock from Juggernaut Cargo Bikes, Molly Herford from theoutdooredit.com, and from Jay Clips. Our question this week, what app do you use to listen to The Outspoken Cyclist? Please pipe up on our Facebook page. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode of the show. And in the meantime, thank you for listening. Please stay safe out there. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Time for The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.